It's Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret.
And I'm Kate Archer-Kent. You're with us on the Ideas Network. Coming up on Central Time, we'll learn about a new phone scam that has been widely reported in Wisconsin.
First, former Oklahoma Attorney General Scott Pruitt was confirmed as the head of the Environmental Protection Agency earlier today in the U.S. Senate. His nomination has been seen as controversial given his contentious relationship with the agency and allegations that he has ties to big energy lobbies.
Yesterday, an Oklahoma judge honored a lawsuit from the Madison-based Center for Media and Democracy, which would require the Oklahoma Attorney General's office to turn over more than 2,500 emails, which are believed to show ties between Pruitt and oil and gas companies.
Nick Sergey joins us now to talk about the lawsuit and Pruitt. He's the director of research for the Center for Media and Democracy. Nick, thanks for joining us today.
Hi, Rob. Good to be with you.
Before we get to the emails, Nick, your reaction to the confirmation earlier this afternoon of Scott Pruitt?
I think it's pretty disappointing for anybody who cares about environmental protection. It's probably a pretty good day for big polluters. If they were to pick anyone to be head of the Environmental Protection Agency, they might well pick Scott Pruitt. So it's a disappointing decision by the Senate.
Now talk about these emails. How long have you been trying to get them under the Oklahoma open records laws?
A long time. Seems like a very, very long time ago. We started looking at Scott Pruitt towards the end of 2014, and we were looking at him because he at that time was really emerging as one of the leading opponents against the Environmental Protection Agency and a leading opponent of various different rules and regulations that they had issued in order to try and curb pollution that was causing global warming and pollution that was affecting safe drinking water and various other rules. And he had filed, well, by the time that he was confirmed, he'd filed 14 lawsuits against the Environmental Protection Agency. And so we were following on from some really good reporting by the New York Times, ended up winning the Pulitzer Prize for their reporting. A big part of that was looking at Scott Pruitt. We started filing public records requests at the beginning of 2015, and we've filed a total of 9 since then. And until last Friday, we were yet to get a single page of any of the documents that they said that they had, but that they were holding back for review. And we didn't get those records on Friday. It was just a tiny fraction of what they said that they have. We didn't get that until we filed a lawsuit. And these are important records. These are email communications, thousands, they say, between Scott Pruitt and coal, oil, and gas companies. And these are companies that Pruitt will now regulate now that he's been appointed and confirmed as head of the Environmental Protection Agency.
Now take us up to yesterday. A judge in Oklahoma ruled in favor of your lawsuit, saying these documents had to be turned over. What did we hear from the judge in issuing that?
So we had argued that that 2 years was too long. Oklahoma law requires prompt disclosure of records, and if they're able to claim some exemption for some of those records. We had been waiting, as I say, for more than 2 years for some of these requests, more than a year for some of the other requests. And we'd said to the court that that's really too long and that there's a particular urgency right now. We'd asked for an expedited hearing because Scott Pruitt is about to become really the world's top regulator as head of the Environmental Protection Agency. Now, the judge granted us an expedited hearing, and then yesterday in court, the judge was really having none of the arguments made by Scott Pruitt's lawyer, and I think did as much as we could hope for, which was that they ordered more than 2,500 emails from our first request to be released next Tuesday. And then thousands of other records we're expecting to get the following week. But unfortunately, they didn't come soon enough for members of the Senate to be able to see those, members of the media, before the Republicans pushed through a vote at the Democrats' objections just this afternoon.
Talking to Nick Sergey from the group, the Center for Media and Democracy. Based in Wisconsin, they had filed lawsuits after years of open records requests looking for records from then Oklahoma Attorney General Scott Pruitt. who was just confirmed earlier today as the head of the Environmental Protection Agency, confirmed in the Senate. Nick, Democratic senators had tried to postpone this hearing until after that scheduled release of the documents on Tuesday. Do you expect that there will be something in there that might have led to a different vote?
I think there may well have been. We know from records that the New York Times that I mentioned had managed to obtain about 2.5 years ago that Scott Pruitt has a very close relationship with a number of coal, oil, and gas companies. And the New York Times was able to get emails that showed Scott Pruitt on a number of occasions received letters that Devon Energy, which is an Oklahoma-based oil and gas company that's quite controversially involved in fracking around the country. They had written a number of letters and asked him if he would submit them under his own name to various federal agencies, asking them to essentially roll back environmental protections. And he did, and he put them on the Oklahoma Attorney General letterhead and presented them and sent them in as if they were his own. The New York Times revealed that. And as I mentioned, they ended up winning the Pulitzer Prize for that reporting. We should have actually got some of those emails ourselves, some of those same emails that the New York Times was able to obtain and published. There's some overlap with our requests. We should have got 27 that we identified that the New York Times had published. We didn't get any of them. All of the kind of embarrassing emails that the New York Times was able to get 2.5 years ago were left out of our request. But there was also more than 2,500 other emails between Scott Pruitt, his chief of staff, and a couple of other top staffers, and a range of coal, oil, and gas companies. So I can't see any reason why, since they didn't claim any exemptions, didn't claim any privilege, that these were documents that were involved in litigation. Maybe they'll make that argument later. But they didn't claim them in holding them back. I can't see any reason why they wouldn't have given us those records, other than they paint a picture of this very friendly, close relationship between Scott Pruitt and companies and industries that he's now going to be overseeing as really the top regulator in the world, at a very crucially important period in our history. We're really running out of time if there's going to be significant action to tackle climate change. And now we have somebody who hasn't been properly vetted. He refused to answer many questions that were put to him by members of the Senate through his confirmation process. They have a constitutional role to play there in terms of vetting nominees, and it's a rigorous process, and it should be, because these are important positions. He didn't answer many of those questions. He has blocked at every turn the release of these emails. And I think that they would have probably told us a lot about that ongoing relationship that we know that he has with many of these companies. But we're still hopeful these emails are going to be published, I should say. We're still going to fight the case. We should get some emails on Tuesday, more the following week, and we have four other pending requests that we're going to continue to fight.
It could be argued, I think the supporters of Pruitt might argue, this isn't so embarrassing that he was in touch with these companies. He was the attorney general of the state, worried about what he perceived as federal overreach from the EPA that was limiting the ability of companies in his state to do business. What is wrong with that?
Well, I think if there's nothing embarrassing in these emails, then he should publish them. I think that there have been emails in the past that have shown him very willing to be the mouthpiece of industries that he's regulating. And, he didn't in anywhere in that letter say, by the way, this is actually the letter that was written by Devon Energy. He presented it entirely as if it was his own, and he was calling for rules that would affect Devon's profits to be rolled back. And that shows a serious conflict of interest in our view.
What are your concerns now? Scott Pruitt has been confirmed as the new head of the EPA, even with these documents out on Tuesday. It's not that likely that it would change things, I imagine. What are your concerns moving forward?
Well, I think there may be things in these records that that would make the case that he may have to recuse himself from certain actions. We'll have to see what we get. Emails that the Times released 2.5 years ago, and I should say the relatively small number of emails that the New York Times obtained, as was it appears a much larger request. We're expecting thousands of emails, so there may be more there. But the emails that the Times presented showed things. There were emails that showed those letters that Devon Energy wrote. There was also more innocuous emails that they received that showed, for example, Scott Pruitt's chief of staff wanting to bring her children to the Devon Tower for a day out. There were emails like that. It was showing a very, very friendly, close, cordial relationship. And so there may be instances where Pruitt, as a result of these emails being published, has to accuse himself. But I think in general what we're concerned about with Scott Pruitt, and many are concerned about this, is that he's a climate change denier. He is someone that has sued the EPA 14 times. He is not somebody that believes in strict environmental protections. There's a lot that he could do as head of the Environmental Protection Agency that would undo a lot of the far too slow, I should say, reforms that have been promoted through the Obama years. And there was frustration that perhaps political capital at the beginning of the Obama years were expended on other issues and not enough on climate change, and that there was, as a result, we're now facing 4 years where we need very, very strong leadership from the United States internationally in order to try and deal with some of the problems, the very intense problems around climate change, and we're very unlikely to get that. I would say it's impossible that we are going to get that from the Environmental Protection Agency headed up by Scott Pruitt.
And Nick, before we wrap up, the judge has ordered these documents you're looking for to be released on Tuesday. Do you expect that will happen, or do you anticipate another legal challenge to prevent that release between now and then?
Well, we'll see. We've heard nothing so far that's indicated that they're going to file an appeal, but that's possible. Of course, up until this point, everything that's happened with the case has happened while Scott Pruitt is the boss of the lawyers who've been defending him and trying to prevent disclosure of these emails. Scott Pruitt is no longer the Attorney General of Oklahoma. He's now the head of the Environmental Protection Agency. And, so it's possible they won't appeal. It is possible they might and decide that they want to continue to defend against these emails, which will really reveal that relationship, I think, in really close detail. It's possible that they're trying to block that. But we'll see. Currently, we're expecting release of these records.
Nick, thanks for joining us today.
Thanks very much.
Nick Sergey is Director of Research for the Center for Media and Democracy based in Wisconsin. He joined us today to talk about a lawsuit that the group has pending that calls for the release of emails sent by now EPA head Scott Pruitt while he was Attorney General of Oklahoma. A judge yesterday demanded the release of those documents next Tuesday.
You're listening to Central Time on the Ideas Network. I'm Kate Archer-Kent.
And I'm Rob Ferret. Coming up on Food Friday, want to make your own state fair-style cream puffs? Our own Lori Skelton shares the secrets of puff pastry.
First, Rob, can you hear me?
Yes. Oh,
okay.
That was a mistake.
Thank you so much. That may be all you need to say to fall victim to a recent phone scam that has been widely reported across Wisconsin. Here's some audio provided by the Better Business Bureau and Pindrop, one of these scam calls.
Hello?
Hi, this is Joe, and I'm a third-party advisor with our company's Department of Health and Safety on a recorded line. Can you hear me okay?
Jim Temmer joins us now. He's the CEO of the Better Business Bureau serving Wisconsin, and he's here to tell us more about the Can You Hear Me phone scam. Jim, welcome to Central Time.
Thank you. It's great to be here.
Start with the basics here of this particular phone scam. What are we listening for?
Sure. Well, what you're listening for is someone on the other end of the phone. They could be fumbling with a headset. They could be making a little commotion, and they'll say, hey, can you hear me? And again, most people normally would answer, just as you did, yes, I can hear you. Well, this is a robocall. It's a recorded voice, and they're trying to get your voice recorded as well.
And what can the scammers actually do with your recorded voice saying the word yes?
Well, we used to see this scam in business-to-business relations often, every year, for selling business supplies and directory ads. And what they'll do is they'll get your voice to say yes, and if it's a trip, if it's travel, if it's donating to a charity, any number of scams, then they'll say, well, you agreed to this. We have you saying yes to it, and we have it on tape. Now, it probably wouldn't stand up in a court of law, but it can be pretty intimidating when they're calling somebody back saying, you didn't pay your bill, and we have you recorded saying yes.
So the scam has quite a history. Do we know where it originated?
No, we do not. And, of course, it's hard to track any of these phone calls because they can spoof caller ID numbers. They can do any of that stuff. Most of these originate outside the boundaries of the United States.
And do these type of scams, do they kind of ebb and flow, come back, they have a resurgence and go away for a while?
You bet they do. Last year, everyone was talking about the IRS scam. Everybody was getting the phone call, which was a recorded phone call, saying you owe the IRS money and pay up now or the police will be at your door. Well, that has dropped off precipitously. Now this one comes back. And I'll tell you, we've had over 500 complaints just since January 30th in Wisconsin on this one alone, and there's probably 10 times that many people that it's happened to. So this has been a pretty large one in the area. You know, you take those numbers down. Actually, I was contacted a week ago Friday in my office by this very scam on my cell phone. I kind of chuckled when I answered it, and I said, this is Josh from Customer Service. Can you hear me? So no one is above getting these phone calls, no matter where you are.
Okay, so what did you do in that instance, and what should someone do?
Well, the one thing I did do that we tell people not to do is don't even answer the phone. In this day and age, if it's someone you don't recognize on that caller ID, don't answer it. If it's important, they will leave a message or call back. But I did answer the phone, and as soon as I heard the gentleman on tape on the other end talking, I wrote the phone number down, and I did report it on our scam tracker at BBB.org, and I reported it to the federal Do Not Call registry. You know, you can get your phone number. It's donotcall.gov. You enter your phone numbers in there. Now, of course, scammers are criminals, and they're going to call you anyway. But you can also report numbers that have called you once you're on the registry. So there's a few important things you can do. And, of course, that'll cut down on your telemarketing and sales calls. Again, it won't help with all the scams, but at least it'll get the law enforcement agencies a couple of numbers they can look up.
We're talking with Jim Temmer. He's CEO of the Better Business Bureau serving Wisconsin. We're talking about the latest phone scam that's been going around that instructs people to actually, really ask people a simple question, can you hear me? And then so many people fall for it and say yes. Jim, what happens if you do say yes? Where do they go with that information? What happens then?
Well, because this is just happening now, we don't know for sure. We assume what's going to happen is that, again, they will be contacting people back who said yes and telling them that they are being billed for certain activities, whatever it was. Another thing that can happen, and has happened in the past, is that yes recording of your voice will be used to put charges on your phone bill or your cell phone bill. So we're telling people, check your bank and credit card statements regularly for any unauthorized charges, you know, even if it's a few cents. Because what can happen is people, if they do get your credit card number, they'll try and sell them in batches to other criminals. But what they'll do is they'll run something through that's just a couple of cents to see if that's caught or not. And if nothing's caught the first time, you better bet it's going to be a higher number the next time it goes through. And also check your telephone and your cell phone bills. Same thing. Scammers might be using that yes recording to put unauthorized charges on your phone bill.
Do we ever end up finding out who is behind any of these scams?
Well, I mentioned the IRS scam earlier, and there was a raid in a city in India, and they shut down a whole organization that was doing these IRS calls to the United States, and it dropped right off. Now, again, maybe somebody else will pick that up, but it's difficult for law enforcement because, like I said, most of these kind of schemes like this take place outside of our border. So you can contact the FBI, you can contact anyone you want, and they have very limited things that they can do when it gets to be overseas.
And are you working with other states in the Better Business Bureau to pool this information you get to help investigate this scam and others?
You bet we are. And there were over 4,500 of these reported across the country. BBB's There are 110 of us in North America, and we in Wisconsin cover the entire state. But we all work together. We're a federated system. You go online, you want to search any company and anywhere in the country, and you can put the name in, and we can get you information on it.
And tell us about how the scam tracker works. And it's available on your website?
That's right, bbb.org, and you can search for backslash, you can search for it or just put backslash scam tracker. There is an interactive heat map there where you can go down to your neighborhood, your zip code, and see what scams are going on, what scams are reported. We've got over 45,000 scams in there right now across the country. You can also look if you have relatives. I know where my mother lives, of course. I see if anything's going on in her area, and if there was, I would call her and tell her about it. We really like to get information out to people. We can't stop scammers from trying these illegal activities, but if we get enough information into people's hands that can empower them and their neighborhoods and their communities, that's the way we can stop this from progressing.
And what kind of trends do you see on your scam tracker? Do you see scams spreading kind of like a cancer, perhaps, or like a tumor? How do they spread?
They usually do. Now, there's everything from the old-fashioned door-to-door scam when people are coming after a hailstorm or they're storm chasers and they're selling you things, or they're saying, oh, you know, we just blacktopped your neighbor's driveway down the block. We've got some extra. We'll cut you a deal. You have to be very careful for these kind of door-to-door scams. Then, of course, the telephone scams like the one we're talking about now. But far and away, what we see are the use of technology, email, phishing email scams, even now social media, Facebook. Scammers are using Facebook. I was just talking to someone about a grant scheme yesterday. They'll hack into a Facebook account, and you will get a message from someone you know and trust saying, hey, did you know about this great website? I just got $50,000 free grant from the government. And you'll go there, and they'll ask you to, you know, put down $1,000 or whatever it is, and it's a total scam. So all of this technology is used by criminals to try and separate you from your money. And then identity theft is rampant. Last year, 1 out of 16 adults in the United States were victimized by identity theft.
Well, Jim, thank you so much for filling us in today.
You bet. Got to be careful out there.
Jim Temmer is the CEO of the Better Business Bureau serving Wisconsin. And we've been talking about a new phone scam that has been reported all over the state.
Coming up, it's Food Friday with some yummy pastry. I'm Rob Barrett.
And I'm Kate Archer-Kent. You're listening to the Ideas Network.
You're listening to Central Time. I'm Rob Barrett.
And I'm Kate Archer-Kent. Coming up, a day without Latinos, a Senate race without Congressman Sean Duffy, and more. That's coming up in our weekly roundup of Wisconsin news.
First, it's Food Friday. You may not think you know what choux pastry is, but if you've ever enjoyed a delicious eclair or even better, a Wisconsin State Fair cream puff, you've experienced the wonder of choux-style pastry making.
And while those sweet uses for choux are enough to get excited about, there are also great savory recipes that use the light and puffy pastry as well. Lori Skelton is a classical music host at WPR and one of our in-house foodies. We asked her to tackle choux pastry this month, and she's here to share her results. Lori, good to have you back.
It's good to be back on this topic.
So choux, C-H-O-U-X.
Correct.
Give us a primer on where this pastry comes from.
The story goes that it was created by one of Catherine de' Medici's chefs in around 1540. And the idea of making a pastry that you have to cook in a saucepan on the stove before you bake it, it got refined and refined over the years. And then in the 18th century, one pastry chef created a little bun that looked like a cabbage, which is choux in French.
Mm.
And that's where the choux pastry came up. That's where the name has come up with. The person who really codified it for this century and beyond was Anton Carême in the 19th century, one of the grand cuisine innovators in France. But as you noted, it's a pastry that's well-loved in Wisconsin, French or not.
Now, when I eat a cream puff at the state fair, I'm thinking, all right, I'm lying. I don't think I just eat it. But when I think back on it, it's like this light, fluffy pastry. And, you know, usually you think yeast and it rises to make something fluffy. That does not enter the picture, right?
No. This is when you cook your pastry on the stove. I call it actually a paste rather than a pastry when you're working with it on the stove. You start off with a liquid and butter, which you'll bring to a boil, and then you dump flour into that, and just like you have to cook out the flour with a roux, mm-hmm. you have to spend about 3 minutes stirring this on the stove so that the flour will actually cook. You then take it off the heat, and you beat in a lot of egg. I mean a lot of egg. And
do you hand beat or do you use electric?
You can do it either way. If you're going to try this for the first time, I would actually recommend that you start by hand beating so you get to know what this pastry feels like. And so that the eggs don't cook, you pull this off the heat, give it a chance to cool down, and then you add your eggs a little bit at a time. And it's going to scare you at first because as you start beating in the egg, it's going to fall to pieces. It's going to look like absolutely slimy Play-Doh. Just keep beating it, beating it, beating it. It will eventually come together, pull away from the sides of the pan, and form this nice ball of firm, pipeable pastry dough.
And then you're ultimately going to, well, you can do different things with it because you tried, we'll get into the specific things. You can bake it. You can also fry it.
I'm sorry, to finish up your question, what makes it puff up in the oven?
Oh, yeah, right. Yeah. What makes it puff up in the oven?
All of that water, all of that liquid in from all of the egg and then the water in the dough. You're going to start your pastry at a very high heat in the oven, at least 400 degrees, if not higher. That's going to create steam, and that's going to make it puff. Then you'll drop your oven temperature slightly, maybe to go from 400 to 350, and finish baking it, and that will give you the crispy shell. You then take your pastry out of the oven, poke a little hole in it so the steam can escape, so it won't get soggy. It will continue to crisp up once you've turned the oven off, and it will dry out that way. And then, yes, you can fry it as well. If you fry choux pastry, you're going to get the French version of a cruller, or you'll get what they call a beignet in New Orleans.
Mm-hmm.
And you can also make a brandade, where you combine soft fish, like cod or poached salmon. You combine that with potatoes and oil, and then you can mix that in with the choux pastry and actually get a savory beignet that you can deep fry. And then a similar technique, although you don't use eggs, it's the batter for churros, which I know a lot of people really enjoy eating. And we actually tried a version that showed up on the Great British Bake Off last year, and this one had coconut flour in it. So I decided to go gluten-free on this and use half coconut flour, half all-purpose gluten-free baking flour. And one of the things we discovered, the reason that churros are piped with a star tip mm-hmm. on your piping bag, you want those ridges to be able to get a little bit extra crispy in the fryer and also to be able to hang on to whatever spices or sugar you sprinkle on the outside. But again, it's the same idea with churros batter. You're going to start your batter, your pastry, your paste on the stove. Same principle, only you don't have eggs with this, but you do cook it on the stove. You beat it, beat it, beat it until it pulls away from the pan and forms a firm ball of paste that, again, you can pipe out into interesting shapes. And usually with churros, you end up dipping them in lovely, interesting things.
Like chocolate.
Chocolate. Cinnamon sugar is the traditional thing you roll them in, and then you dunk them in chocolate. But
hot chocolate, too, is very good, yes.
And that's the neat thing about choux pastry. It is a little bit intimidating to get started. I'm not saying you're going to get it right off the bat, but once you learn how to work this, it is incredibly versatile and a lot of fun to play with.
We're talking with Lori Skelton. She is our in-house foodie here at WPR. We've been learning about choux pastry all week long, and it's been so much fun. You've been experimenting, and as you experiment, we benefit from that because you bring it into the WPR kitchen, and stick around and ask people for feedback.
It's impossible to make just one churro or one one cream puff. You have to make a batch of these, darn it all. And so, yes, we did have a lot of fun going through batches of wonderful pastry things this week.
And here's the one we have up on the Central Time Facebook page and at WPR.org. This is one you brought in. You did cream puffs, but you did double chocolate mini cream puffs. So chocolate, the double, the filling chocolatey, and the, yeah, the puff itself chocolatey.
I mentioned the Great British Bake Off, which is a show I'm mildly obsessed with. And a couple of years ago, they had an eclair challenge, and one of the contestants made a chocolate choux pastry filled with mango cream. And I thought, well, I have to try this. They did not put her recipe on the internet. I don't know if they've published it in a book, but I suddenly went hunting chocolate choux pastry. Not many people do it. If you go online and look for chocolate eclairs or chocolate cream puffs, you will see a regular eclair or a regular cream puff doused in chocolate sauce. I had to do some digging before I was able to find a couple of examples of chocolate choux pastry. So I put together my own version of chocolate choux pastry based on a bunch of recipes. And then the chocolate whipped cream is actually a milk chocolate whipped cream that comes from the woman who started the Chocolat chain of stores. I think her name is Alice Medrick, and she has a way to make white chocolate, milk chocolate, or dark chocolate whipped cream. So we use the milk chocolate whipped cream in our cream puffs this week. And based on the comments I got, this is worth trying out. It's they weren't too heavy, they weren't too sweet, but everybody said they were a really good balance.
Lori, I prefer to prep all my ingredients beforehand. I think the word is mise en place.
Mise en place?
Type of cook. Yes.
Mise en place?
I'm a mise en place type of cook. And I have to say, I'm wondering if that would work in my advantage in the situation.
Absolutely. This is one time where I know a lot of people laugh when they see a cooking show and all the little ingredients are set out in the bowls and you just lift and dump and lift and dump. That actually is a lot of common sense when it comes to any kind of cooking, but especially for something like this when you are having to be so quick on time with getting your flour incorporated. You don't want your water and butter to be sitting there over boiling while you're then measuring out flour. Then again, you don't want your choux paste to get too cool while you're measuring out your eggs. So yes, if you are a cook that gets all of your ingredients ready to go before you even start, if you have your baking sheets out and ready to go, if you have the piping tip already in your piping bag, you are going to have an easier time working with choux pastry. And if you're not one of those cooks, again, this would be a great way to practice it because it's not that many ingredients, but there is a time element.
Timing is of an essence.
Absolutely.
We're talking with WPR music host and in-house foodie Lori Skelton about choux pastry and the wide variety of treats that it can be the base of.
And we want to hear from you on this week's edition of Food Friday at 800-642-1234. Have you ever made your own eclairs or cream puffs or other items that use this kind of choux, that's C-H-O-U-X, dough? Was it easy, hard, success, failure? Do you need some advice? Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. Or do you just love eating cream puffs, maybe at the state fair? Post on the Central Time Facebook page if you want. You can check out Lori's recipe for double chocolate mini cream puffs.
We'll pick up this conversation in just a bit here on Central Time.
You're listening to Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret.
And I'm Kate Archer-Kent. We're continuing our conversation with WPR in-house foodie Lori Skelton about making your own choux pastries at home.
Have you tried this kind of baking with choux flour, baking cream puffs or eclairs or something savory with them? How did it come out for you? What's the secret to success? Or do you have some questions about how to do this? Call in at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. Or you can post on the Central Time Facebook page, find Lori's recipe. It's an elusive one for chocolate cream puff, double chocolate, actually, mini cream puffs.
And Lori, you were getting feedback all week long from WPR people, all around staff, and you were taking copious notes on what people thought of your creations. What were some of the aha moments?
One of the aha moments with the double chocolate mini cream puffs was simply that idea of you don't want this too heavy. Yeah, we think of that incredible cream puff we get at the state fair, which you have to be kind of slow to eat it, and you do sort of feel a bit stodgy afterwards. I was sitting here thinking I'd have to come up with something that would just hit you in the face with chocolate, but this was one case where double chocolate, pull it back, was actually more flavorful. That said, somebody did suggest that it might be nice if, you know, when you have a cream puff and you dust it with powdered sugar, maybe I could have mixed in a little bit of cocoa powder with powdered sugar and then dusted the cream puffs with that.
Triple chocolate.
Well, actually, I've got a suggestion for how to do triple chocolate on the recipe online. There is a difference between a cream puff and a profiterole. Cream puff is full of whipped cream. Profiterole is full of ice cream in choux pastry. So if you want to go triple chocolate, I'd say do a profiterole. Put your favorite chocolate ice cream inside the chocolate choux paste and then drizzle chocolate sauce on top of that.
Wash down with hot chocolate. We'll
there
go to our
go.
Callers now. Keith is with us in Green Bay. Keith, hi.
Good afternoon. I make choux pastry. I found a recipe years ago, and it's called a French recipe called Gousserre's.
Yes.
I make them quite small. I only pipe them about the size of a quarter, but they puff up to about the size of a 50-cent piece. And then I fill them with things like salmon mousse or a little liver pate, kind of a little filling. And I find that it's a very nice, savory appetizer.
What kind of liver? What kind is chicken liver?
I just basically take like a Braunschweiger liver and mix it up with cream cheese.
So we had that's so funny that you say that, Keith. We had a savory one that Lori made with a crab filling, and multiple people recommended.
One person recommended
Braunschweiger. Or liverwurst. Yeah.
Yeah. That's
on the same wavelength.
That is so marvelous. And okay, so I'm just curious, Keith, when you found this recipe, what was it about the recipe that really got to you? Why did you want to try this?
I was looking for an appetizer, and although it looks complicated, it's very simple.
Okay.
I found that making that choux pastry, you know, it's so few ingredients. They puff up beautifully. You can have a tray that's, you know, a pyramid of these things, and it looks terribly complicated. But basically, it's just flour and water and eggs, and you beat it, and you pipe it out, and you bake it. I had never heard the tip of puncturing them a little bit so that they release their steam, because I make them so small.
Right.
But then when I would put in, like, the liver with the cream cheese and pipe that in, or salmon with the cream cheese and pipe that in, and then just people just think you're a whiz.
Yeah. Yep. How to impress with minimal effort. Good on ya.
Thanks so much, Keith, for the call.
And you made yours with crab.
Right. I've had gougere for years, but I'd never had them filled until recently. I just love to eat them hot out of the oven, usually with a glass of inexpensive bubbly. But here was a recipe, again, Great British Bake Off, where instead of making a little round puff, you pipe them out into what the creator of the recipe called a barquette, a little canoe. And you cut it in half, and she filled hers with crab salad and then smoked salmon and then marinated shrimp. So today I just brought in just the crab salad for everyone to try. And then I asked everybody, what else would you do? And yes, Braunschweiger was mentioned. Any number of mayonnaise-based salads.
Chicken salad.
Chicken salad, tuna salad, even egg salad, which I wouldn't have thought of with Gruyere cheese.
And you could go a vegetarian way as well.
Somebody suggested make a stew of tomatoes and eggplant. That would be incredible. Somebody else suggested chutneys, perhaps mixed with goat cheese. One person, I love this suggestion, pickled vegetables. I could see on these tiny little golden brown barquettes one perfect pickled asparagus spear. Perfect centerpiece for a Packer party.
Go back to our callers now. We've got Hazel on the line in Verona. Hazel, hi.
Hi, how are you?
Good. What did you want to tell us about, Hazel?
I was making choux.
So you've made it?
Yeah, I've made it before.
But can I ask how old you are, Hazel?
9 years old.
Wow, fantastic. What made you want to make shoe?
So I was watching the British baking show.
Yep.
And all of a sudden they came up with shoe. You had to make something with shoe.
And so what did you do with it? What did you fill your it was like a sweet thing that you made?
Yeah, I made it sweet. I love sweet things.
Okay. Now, I've got a question. When you beat in your eggs, did you beat them in by hand, or did you put them in the mixer or the food processor?
If I remember right, we did mixer.
Okay, because I know when I was 9 years old, I would not have had the arm strength to do it by hand. I will say this. When that paste starts getting firm, you really need muscles to keep beating it for 3 to 5 minutes. So good for you for using the mixer. Good for you for using the tools that will make it easier.
And Hazel, thanks a lot for calling in, and good luck. And, you know, drop some by next time you make them.
And pastry, regardless, can be a little intimidating, even specifically what type of flour you use. Mm-hmm. Now, you used a different type of flour.
I wanted to experiment because they are so versatile. You can get creative with the flour. As I said, I used gluten-free for the churros. And depending on how familiar you are with gluten-free flours, churros are a great way to find out how a gluten-free flour will work. Same thing with the sweeter shoe buns. There again, you can play with gluten-free flours. I wouldn't go a nut flour. That's probably going to be a little bit oily, but you can work with some of the gluten-free flours there. When you get into the savory ones, the gougère that we had today, or if you're going to make the actual towers of pastry, what the French call a croquembouche or a religieuse à la ancienne, actual towers of puff pastry or eclairs, there you're going to want a pastry that's going to be a little bit firmer. So with the gougère today, I actually used bread flour. And I cooked those a little bit longer, made sure they were nice and crispy and firm to stand up, especially if you are going to have a wetter filling. But here again, you can get as creative as you want in terms of flour, in terms of spices or herbs that you put in. You can have an awful, as Hazel just found out, you can have an awful lot of fun with it.
Let's bring on one more caller. Thank you, Hazel. We'll go next to Dolores in Kenosha. Dolores, hi.
Oh, hi. My goodness. It probably was 25 years ago. My sisters and I figured out how to make shoe pastry. And it was so easy. And it's like, why did we do this before?
Good.
So for Christmas, we had the family thing. And we're talking 30 people. Now, you can do roasts and all that kind of thing. But it wasn't that kind of group. So what we did was we decided to make a bunch of little shoe. And once you make the dough, we scooped it up, like a 1 tablespoon scoop, and baked all these up. And then we filled them with savory things. And we basically did ham salad, tuna salad, and egg salad.
Great. Dolores, we're just about out of time. Thank you so much for calling. But that's the great thing about these.
Yeah.
They could be an appetizer, an hors d'oeuvre, or make a bunch of them, and it's a meal, and you fill them with different stuff.
And Dolores does bring up a good point. I've been talking about using a piping bag, and if you don't want to go that route, if you don't mind your shoe buns looking a little bit ragged, go ahead and drop them by teaspoons full onto your baking tray. You'll be just fine.
It's very versatile.
It is. It is a lot of fun. I am enjoying this particular pastry, and the reason I decided to do this, somebody on staff said, hey, you know what my girls and I did this weekend? We made eclairs. We didn't know you could do that. So I thought, well, if everybody's kids are getting in on it, why not the rest of us?
So we'll make a date this summer. We'll cook up a bunch of our own cream puffs and then go park outside of the state fair and undercut them.
No.
I think that's straight to prison in Wisconsin. It wouldn't be the same.
But keep it in mind for next winter when you are missing a cream puff.
That's true.
Make your own.
Little taste of summer. Lori, as always, thank you so much.
Thank you.
That's Lori Skelton, classical music host at WPR, one of our in-house food experts. You can find her recipe for double chocolate mini cream puffs puffs and then make them and then eat them. You can find that recipe linked over at the Central Time Facebook page. Over time, some of the basic numbers in the world of science changed with new developments. The four elements, earth, water, fire, and air, they've been replaced by the periodic table with 100-plus elements and counting. Our nine-planet solar system is down to 8 after Pluto got reclassified, and it could go back up to 9 again, according to some scientists.
And now the number of continents on our planet may need to be updated. In research published by the Geological Society of America, a group of scientists say the area surrounding New Zealand qualifies as a continent, which they propose calling Zealandia.
Most of that's underwater, which I would have thought meant, no, it's not a continent. It's oceans with some islands. But they say the definition of a continent has four parts. It's elevation above the surrounding area, even if it's underwater, distinctive geology, a well-defined area, and a crust thicker than the regular ocean floor. They say by those standards, yep, continent.
Yep, but don't throw out your globes and textbooks just yet. There's no official board that lists continents, so there will be a lot of scientific back and forth before this is a done deal.
I mean, if this takes and Zealandia is a thing, we can talk about the 8 continents from A to Z, right? Because right now we only go from A to
S. I guess, Rob, you would only think that, yes.
Just thought of it now.
Oh, okay, well, you know, enlightened.
All right, we'll keep tracking this new continent as developments ensue over the million-year scale of continental drift. This is Central Time on the Ideas Network.